And now we're with Professor Fareed Azak, and he's going to be presenting at the special event next week from South Africa to Israel. Now, Fareed is a South African scholar, writer, and political activist known for his opposition to apartheid, his appointment by Nelson Mandela as a gender equity commissioner, and his work for interreligious dialogue. He's currently a professor at Johannesburg University in South Africa. So, Fareed, thank you so much for being available and coming on our program today.
I'm delighted to be here.
I really appreciate it. I know it's late at night for you. It's after 10:30 p.m. now, and so we do appreciate in Hamilton that you're taking the time to do this. And, I mean, this is very exciting. Israel Apartheid Week has happened a few times now, and this is going to be a particularly big one, I think, because there is a series of events or sequence of events planned, and you are a keynote speaker for this week. Again, you're going to be speaking on March the 2nd here, right here at McMaster in Hamilton Hall, and I'll give more details about that for the listeners later on. But, you know, essentially we have this Apartheid Week coming up, the Israel Apartheid Week, and I'm just wondering, have you heard anything about Israel Apartheid Week taking place in Canada or North America and perhaps the perceptions of Israel in Canada? Have you had time to experience or think about that issue?
Well, the Israeli Apartheid Week, in fact, first merged in Canada a few years ago when a group of students decided to have it at McMaster. And then the graduates of McMaster went off to other places and they spread the idea into other places where they went. And it is now a movement that is broadly accepted in very, very many parts of the world. Here in South Africa, activists are furiously organizing at so many different universities and in other parts of the world. Several veteran South African activists in the anti-Israeli apartheid struggle are flying into other parts of the world to support moves there. So it's a movement that has gained rapid credibility, grown widespread in the last 10 years, and all indications are that things will only get better for this movement. And of course, it causes a lot of resentment. There are many Israelis, some of them are rather decent people, who just bitterly resent the connection or the coupling of something that they regard as anathema, as an absolute insult to humanity, this apartheid, that this should be connected to a state that they uphold as one of the ideals for the Jewish people. So it's caused a lot of upset around people in many parts of the world.
But at the same time, what I'm getting from you is that the actions in Canada, the organizing of Israel Apartheid Week at McMaster and other universities has actually inspired activists in South Africa. Is that right then?
Oh, absolutely. The solidarity actions that was first initiated in Canada has inspired a lot of people in South Africa. And this is not the first time that this has been the case. There have been many campaigns during the apartheid era in Canada, in Britain, in America, where people, whether these were smaller campaigns or boycotting Outspan Oranges, and people there were a deep source of support and encouragement and inspiration for the black mass suffering people of South Africa. So this whole idea of international solidarity movements, mutual inspiration, drawing support from other people's movements, learning from strategies and so on, It is something that has come on from the 70s onwards. It is now only in the last few years that this is being applied in a broader way to the struggle against Israeli apartheid. But it is becoming increasingly common.
Wow, I have to say, in some ways, it's good to see the struggle coming full circle. My own family, for example, was involved in the anti-apartheid struggle in relation to South Africa back in the 1980s. I remember my family would go into grocery stores with activists and identify the South African products that were being boycotted and ask if the managers could remove those products. In fact, we always make use of our posters when we're done with them as scrap paper, and I still have pieces of paper in my house on the back of them that say boycott grapes from that struggle. So, I mean, it's wonderful to be receiving support now from South Africa after activists in Canada were supporting the liberation struggle there. So it's good to see this kind of international cooperation. And, you know, given the symmetry in the struggles, how do you feel about coming to Canada to speak about this issue?
This is a duty. Many Canadians, throughout the years of the struggle against apartheid, Canadians came to South Africa. We came to South Africa to rally Canadians against apartheid. to come to Canada to rally Canadians against anti-apartheid Israel, it is for us to continue simply unfinished business. We have long acknowledged the similarities between racial apartheid in South Africa and racial apartheid in Israel. And in the recognition of that, we have reaffirmed our commitment that we will never see that kind of thing again. And so we're coming to Canada to alert the Canadians to the perniciousness of tribalism, to the persistence of tribalism, and to alert the Canadians to their own responsibilities to at least, if they cannot participate in the liberation of the Palestinians, that they should not become complicit in the oppression of the Palestinian people. And this then means a call for a boycott of Israeli goods, sanctions against Israeli companies, and for a divestment from Israeli companies. Many forms of other kinds of struggle, particularly violent forms of struggle, are being closed to Palestinians. One of the few options that the Palestinians have is the question of non-violent struggle, the right to withhold their services, the right to withhold their goods from the Israelis. And they deserve our support. When things go wrong, when we see violent manifestations of rebellion, all of us have a fat lot to say. And we do not then come up with anything concrete. And I think that the boycott, divestment, the boycott and divestment initiative is one way of ensuring that at least our own hands doesn't get tainted in what has become increasingly a very visible and a very palpable racist regime.
Well, on the subject of boycott and sanctions, there's been discussion as to how effective boycott or sanctions were in the case of South Africa and ending the apartheid regime there. Do you think that boycott or sanctions can be effective in the case of Israel?
Boycotts and, sanctions were largely effective in South Africa as part of a package of other measures. There was the armed struggle, there was the boycott movement, there was the ending, the military embargo on South Africa's, and just generally a number of other factors that made it very expensive for apartheid to continue surviving in its then form. I think that boycotts are a limited weapon. They are often ineffective weapons, but the truth is that there is nothing that irks the occupying powers as much as a suggestion of boycott. For once, the sense that they are completely in control, it is derailed. And authoritarian structures, oppressive regimes, have great difficulty coping when it is seen that their systems are failing, and that part of the initiative has receded into the hands of those communities that they have sought to oppress. But boycotts best work in consultation with a series of other programs. And so from our side as an international community, this is our responsibility. But internally, in Palestine, the Palestinians would have to evolve different ways of non-collaboration with the apartheid regime. The Palestinians from inside would have to make the occupation as costly as possible for the Israeli regime. From the inside, the Palestinians must engage in different moves to assert their own humanity in the face of Zionism's determination to deny the humanity of the non-Jewish other.
We're making comparisons here between South Africa and Israel, and I know that there's going to be discussion over the similarities, but it also brings to mind a discussion of the differences. And I'm just wondering, what do you think are some of the key differences between South Africa and Israel if you're discussing relations of inequality or apartheid?
I think there are several differences. In the South African relationship between South African whites and South African blacks, there was never a moment when the blacks in South Africa wanted the whites of South Africa to be driven in the sea. moment in South African history when the whites of South Africa adopted as a national policy the ending, the ethnic cleansing of the black people. Black and white South Africans have always realized that they needed each other at some point. White South Africa, at a very limited rate, engage in immigration from the outside as a way to change the demographics. Never enough to seriously pose a threat to the black demographic numbers in South Africa. In Israel, the demographic figure is a huge factor. There is a desperation in national policy and strategic thinking. How do we consistently reduce the amount of Palestinians and bring in the others who could fill in the spaces that are left over now by an increasingly ethnically cleansed Palestinian community? South Africa did not have blanket torture. South Africa did not have regimes of punishment that destroyed people's groves. In South Africa, after some years of people living together, people understood, for better or for worse, we have to live together. In Israel, because of the very nature of Zionism, there has to be a continuous influx from other people of the world, staking their claim onto the land of Zion. And when there is this ongoing shift in the demographics of what Israeli or Zionist society is, you are never able to reach a permanent settlement with your neighbors. In South Africa, after all these years, black and white were forced to sit together because black and white were relatively stable entities in South Africa. In Israel, there is nothing stable about Israeli society. There is a continuous coming in of people. You make them Filipino Jews, you make them Latin American Jews. They come in from Russia, they come in from Germany, they come in from Morocco. They may be Jews, they may not be Jews, but because of Zionism, there is this insistent idea on the ingathering. And once you have this ingathering of all these generations of people who have got nothing in common with falafel or with hummus or the sanctity of the place, except the Israeliness by birthright, then there is no internal imperative for them to embrace the local Palestinian people as possible partners for coexistence in the future.
Now, I noticed on that subject, you mentioned that the Israeli state seems to have a different conception of collective punishment than South Africa did. Would you be able to comment on that?
In Israel, if, for example, a stone was thrown from your family, that's a mild case scenario. Or say a rocket was fired from a particular neighborhood or from a particular building, without assessing who was the guilty partner where that stone came from. In Israeli law, you are entitled to go and destroy the whole building as a measure of punishment for that one particular individual who threw that stone from that building. This is a kind of collective punishment. Not only that, if one of your children is suspected of being engaged in illegal activity, the Israeli Defense Force is able to come and raise the entire olive grove that belongs to the extended family. And the son who may be a radical, the son who may have been throwing stones, may not have reached an age in his family where he had contributed anything to that orange grove or to that olive grove. But the family as a whole has to suffer the consequences for what the child did. Of course, this is a completely opposite result. The family then responds in solidarity to the beatings and the kickings or the jailing that this incalcitrant son has gotten at the hands of the Israeli army.
Well, we're dealing with a very lopsided dynamic of power relations here. And you know, I know you've noted the tendency among some commentators to refer to the Israel-Palestine conflict, but you seem to believe that this term, Israel-Palestine conflict, is a misnomer, or maybe a term that is simply not helpful. So why do you think that term is not the best term to use?
You see, people use these terms as covers for their own refusal or inability to get involved. When you want to keep it simply to a news item that I want to quickly look at and get on with my coffee, get on with the rest of the day, it is then that we resort to titles like this. So you call this husband beating up his wife solidly, cripples her, you say, well, you know, the domestic dispute between these two couples. I kind of know that's bad, but I want to continue with my life and I'm not going to get involved in the lives of these two people. So this is how language is used as tools of oppression against the marginalized. I think it also is convenient for Israel to use it as the Israeli-Palestinian question, introducing the element of symmetry and the suggestion that the complete lack of power on the one, second-hand, third-hand, homemade rockets on the one hand, and on the other hand, these very sophisticated missiles that the Israelis have. So you put all of this together and you say, oh, it's two sides at war with each other, two sides who can't agree with each other. In this task, you make this conflict very, very sexy for all these uncommitted people, people who don't care a damn except just switching the radio on, switching it off for a minute. You make it very sexy for them on the one hand, and on the other hand, make sure that the unbalanced nature, reflecting the inherently unequal nature of this, that remains obscure. And so you talk about, this couple, they're having issues among themselves, or you talk about domestic issues, or you talk about the Israeli-Palestine issue without referring to the reality words, apartheid, oppression, domination, exploitation, racism. But these words are seen as loaded words, as political words, and the other seen as neutral words. And this is, of course, one of the great victories of Zionist propaganda in our age today.
You talk about loaded words and the difficulty of discussing things. And I think, you know, it used to be very difficult to speak out against apartheid in South Africa, whether you're in South Africa or North America, because our governments in North America had lent open or covert support to the apartheid regime. They called Mandela a terrorist. They called his supporters terrorists. And, you know, that had to change. And as you know, after a period of time, everyone suddenly wanted to say that they were for Mandela all along. And I think something similar has been happening. I mean, do you think it's becoming easier to discuss Israel's treatment of the Palestinians now?
Absolutely. And the change from discussing Mandela as a terrorist to accepting the decency, the statesmanlike nature of this wasn't a change that they were responsible for. It was the sheer amount of work and activism on our part that forced these changes onto it. Then, of course, once they recognize Mandela, they try to strip Mandela of all of his commitment to justice and activism, and now want to reduce him to a nice Sunday school teacher who has multi-religious classes and so on, but happily has all these kids singing on his laps. Mandela wasn't the fighter for justice. But in the same case, we see that today's activists who are struggling, the same games of marginalization are being played. And it is just a matter of time when more and more people are going to be seeing this, in large part because they are unable to contain the extent of their terror. They have to inflict all of the crimes that they're inflicting on the Palestinians all the time. And so it is only a time, I mean, we've seen the last time with Gaza, the enormous amount of disturbance that it caused in the Jewish community. Very many decent Jews were deeply troubled by this and no longer bought into this propaganda of the Israel of the Palestinian as the automatic began to think and to see for themselves. You see it in the Shemanista movement, the young kids in Israel. You look at it in the Jewish press, both in Israel and in a country like ours. Now with the Goldstone report, it clearly business is not business as usual. And they are, of course, far more upset about all the different activities that are going to be taking place in the coming week in relation to and to Israel and the apartheid week.
Absolutely. And that brings up the question of justice and the fact that everyone, no matter who you are, what religion you are, you're Jewish, you're Muslim, you're Christian, you're not religious, everyone has a place of participating in justice. And just before we go, I noticed you have a book called But Musa Went to Faran, and it's a compilation of questions and answers about the role of Muslims in the South African struggle for liberation. I hope I pronounced Faran correctly. I probably didn't. But I mean, this just brought a question to my mind. And that is, what is, in the essence of it, what is the role of Muslims in the South African struggle for liberation?
The role of the Muslims in South African struggle in liberation at that time was to fight apartheid, to use religion to fight two things, to fight apartheid as a systemic system that oppresses people on the basis of race. But it was also to use religion as a means of liberating religion itself, because religion can also discriminate against people from other groups and its own internal groups who are different from what the majority wants. In the anti-apartheid era, the struggle was clear. It's not that clear in the post-apartheid society. Now the role of religion is to refuse to be co-opted by the state, to continue to look out for those who are left behind. Whether these left behind people are people living with HIV and AIDS, whether these left behind people are gay people whose marriages are not being recognized, whether these left behind people are poor people who can't have access to health care. These are the new forms of struggle today. And so the struggle for liberation is not a struggle simply for colored people or black people to be getting a space at the table of the whites. It's a struggle about the liberation of all people. So as a South African, then, the struggle for liberation is about all of those things, but it is also a struggle for the liberation of those people who gave us their everything during our struggle. And it is now our turn to be giving something back to them, the neighboring countries in South Africa. The Palestinian people who stood by us in the non-aligned movement, who inspired us in our liberation struggle. So this is one of the central principles of international struggle. It's a question of solidarity. So we owe a hell of a lot to our new country. Our new country will never be complete, or the dreams of our country will never be complete, because we have seen, and I've been to Palestine many times, we have seen the absolutely stark images of what we had experienced in South Africa. Many a struggle hero from South Africa had gone and said that nothing that they had seen of apartheid in South Africa is comparable to what they have seen in Israel. Israel is a much worse case of apartheid. So if I have recognized this, then I must act. And so this is the South African message to the people of the world. We understand that it was easy for you to act on our side, in part because you imagined that the Afrikaners were so utterly other, so utterly different from you. Today, it is difficult for you to act for two reasons. The one is the crimes of Israel is in many ways the product of things went wrong when your civilization committed unspeakable crimes against the Israelis. And the second reason why you have difficulty acting against Israel is because they form part of what you have constituted as a single kind of civilization, the Judeo-Christian civilization, which increasingly after September the 11th exists in opposition to the Muslims or the Arabs. So we understand that today you have difficulty doing for Israel, for Palestinians, what you have done for South Africans before. But I will argue that we are human beings and our choices are based on moral impulses. They're not only based on whether it is in your immediate self-interest or not. And this is why we call upon Europe and North America to join us in our various acts of solidarity with the Palestinian people in the coming week, and to work towards the isolation of the Israeli regime so that an order can emerge there based on justice and peace for all the citizens of that land, Muslims, Christians, Jewish, people of any faith, people of no faith. The land ultimately belongs to the people who live in it.
Yes, well, I think it's absolutely fantastic that you're involved in all of these diverse forms of activism and thus are able to bring us this detailed and sophisticated analysis of the situation. So I think we're going to be looking forward to seeing you next week. And I thank you so much for taking your time to be on our program today.
It's a pleasure, and thank you very much for having me over. And I look forward to being in Canada next.